Welcome back to Posting Through It. I'm your host, Jared Holt. This week, I have Adam Kovacevic. He's from Chamber of Progress. We're going to talk a bit about the Elon Musk takeover of Twitter. If you use Twitter, if you follow tech news, this has been pretty much the main focus of that website for the last week and a half or so. And I'm sure some of the things we talk about, you know, by the time I upload this podcast, there will be 10 more things. But Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself, about Chamber of Progress, just in case people aren't familiar?
Sure. I basically spent my career at the intersection of tech policy, the tech industry, and Democratic politics. So I worked in Capitol Hill for Democratic members of Congress, particularly some of the members of Congress who were the beginnings of the, what we call the New Democrats in the late 90s, who really viewed themselves as pro-technology. They were some of the first kind of tech advocates on Capitol Hill, and that definitely informed my thinking. I spent a dozen years later in my career at Google in the Washington, D.C. office working on public policy issues, worked for one of the scooter companies, Lime, but was really interested in kind of promoting essentially a kind of a technology optimist view, particularly among Democratic policymakers. So our organization works exclusively with Democratic policymakers at the federal, state, and local level, because we're trying to kind of play a role in the debate that Democrats are having amongst themselves about how to approach technology and in innovation.
And that debate has included a lot of things. Antitrust, every time a politician mentions Section 230, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. But
mine too.
Yeah, but this Elon Musk takeover of Twitter, for a long time it was, will he or won't he? Then there was that court case, and now he's got the company. It's his now, and it has gone private. You know, I am maybe a bit more cynical here, a bit less optimistic than you will be, but I'm really excited to talk about it with you because you do have that optimistic vision. And I think this will be really interesting because a lot of folks that I know, having a media background and a research background, are kind of worried about what is going to happen at Twitter. You know, the first week has been totally wild. Mass layoffs, sloppy rollouts of new features. This morning, Elon making political endorsements for Republicans and saying that he wants to sue advocacy groups that have tried to dissuade advertisers from making buys on the platform. I'm curious, you know, it's been only, what, like a week and a half? And I feel like if I really committed to that readout of everything that's happened, that would be the whole episode. But I'm curious what your read on all of this has been as somebody who has worked, you know, directly with a lot of these companies, talked to policymakers. You know, are you worried about the future of Twitter?
Well, I guess I would take a step back and first say that Twitter has always occupied kind of a really interesting space in the tech industry, which is that it has this massive influence on politics, on journalism, on discussion among kind of elites and the public conversation. And yet, as a business, it's never, ever been anywhere close to as successful or big as Meta or Google. So it sort of punches above its weight. And there's always been this question of, you know, how does Twitter, the company, kind of find more economic success to match its kind of cultural influence, right, on the debate? And, you know, I think that Musk and others have looked at Twitter and said, just from a business lens, and say, like, there are things that we could be doing to put the company, kind of vault the company to the next level business-wise, right, revenue-wise. And there's, you know, frankly, I think even if you just look at the business question, there's like an interesting debate, which is that, you know, Twitter, almost all of its revenue comes from advertising, and almost all of that advertising revenue comes from brand advertising, which is very different from the kind of advertising that powers most of Google and Meta's advertising engine. It's mostly big brands advertising, and they are fundamentally, they have been looking for essentially as a safe place to advertise, right? And the size of the Twitter audience and like the influence level of the Twitter audience, I think, is very attractive to those advertisers. On the other hand, and so generally, if you're a platform and you're trying to make your platform attractive to brand advertisers, you have an interest in having it be sort of brand safe, right? Which is to say, like, an advertiser doesn't want their ad to appear next to a, you know, white supremacist tweet, right? The flip side of that is there are people who's, I think Musk and others in his orbit, who say, look, like, maybe we should be diversifying Twitter's revenue stream so that we shouldn't be as dependent on advertising revenue, and maybe there's some kind of subscription or user revenue that we can sort of simultaneously pursue. And I think that they're clearly heading in that direction, and we'll see what happens there. But, you know, they view that as a positive to be kind of less dependent on advertising revenue. The question is, can you do both? Can you both kind of become more, you know, successful in user revenue while also, what do you do with brand advertising revenue? So there's that. Then there's this question of kind of content moderation and speech online, mm-hmm. right? And there I would say, I think that what happens is that there's essentially a pretty familiar learning curve that almost everybody who starts a social network goes through, which is many of these social networks, particularly on the right, have started with this idea of kind of like, oh, well, these big tech platforms are over-censoring people and they're removing too much content, and we're going to be the free speech, you know, network, right? And the funny thing is, even if you look at the conservative leaning outlets like Parler and Truth Social and Getter, they've all started implementing more content moderation, right? Because they kind of realized that, like, if you really allowed unfettered free speech, your site would quickly become a wasteland. And what happens if you become a wasteland is that you become known as a wasteland, right? One of the, you know, I remember early in my Google career, Google acquired YouTube. And YouTube, very early on, even before it was acquired by YouTube, had decided it was going to take a hard line against allowing any adult pornography videos on YouTube. Now, it could have legally, right?
Right.
But the thesis was that if you allowed adult pornography, you'd become known as a porn site, right?
Yeah.
And so they made that decision. Twitter has made all these decisions. Every platform, even this supposed, you know, conservative free speech platforms, have made those decisions. And I think what you see now is kind of like, you know, Musk going along that learning curve, which is essentially like, you can say you want to allow more speech, but fundamentally, if you also want to make your social network attractive to people to spend time on and attractive to advertisers, then you have to engage in content moderation.
Yeah, I've said that. There's the advertiser question, of course. There's, you know, depending on what level of free speech utopia you make, there could even be, you know, the occasional legal liability, or at least the burden of, you know, if you're a platform like Gab and there's a mass shooter there, or like, you know, a bunch of people that law enforcement is maybe interested in, you've got to field all these requests. So there's a bit of an interest not to have that. And I think, speaking to that learning curve, we've already seen Elon Musk do this because he's addicted to posting and, you know, shares his every thought, where, you know, it started as, if it's allowed under the law, it should be allowed on Twitter. And now it is that, but no bots. Also, well, obviously, we have to take some stuff down. And also, don't impersonate accounts. And, you know, there's like all these things added to it. You know, in one possibility, or at least how I see it, there's like kind of two paths forward. One is that Elon Musk and the people in his, you know, around the table, I'm sure both literally and metaphorically, in his orbit, really hammer down and commit to it and say, you know, we don't care, we'll lose money at first, but this utopia idea is something we're really committed to. And then the other option that I can envision is that they go through what you were describing, the just total crash course that every other platform goes to. And I am glad you pointed to like Parler as an example. So Parler, free speech place, capital right happens, it loses Amazon Web Services, it loses its place on the App Store. And, you know, for several months afterward, Parler would introduce all these new moderation efforts and filters and whatnot, essentially auditioning to get back on these services because they realize how crucial they are to, you know, just, well, in their case, just operating to begin with, but also, you know, trying to make their product viable. And, you know, something else I always bring up is the user experience too. And you touched on that as well. If you become known as a wasteland, if Twitter becomes a place to go see the N-word posted 1,000 times instead of, you know, what, you know, it's obtained cultural relevance for, then people won't want to use it as much. So, you know, out of those options, I imagine you're probably hopeful for the second one, that, you know, Elon Musk and the company does learn. But, you know, even as a self-described tech optimist, do you have any reservations? Or obviously we can't predict the future, but, you know, how do you see this playing out?
Actually, it's not even about optimism. I just think it's, for me, it's just the reality of kind of what kind of business, you know, what the natural conclusion, the inevitable, I view it as an inevitable conclusion, right? Which is to say, what kind of business do you want? Do you want to be Parler, who, you know, is a free speech network, but it has very limited maximum appeal, right? Because, like, who wants to spend that much time, you know, bathing in conspiracy theories, right? Parler is a great social network for spouting off and saying what you want, but it's not a great business. On the other hand, look at Instagram. You know, Twitter has, I don't know, 300 million users or something like that. Instagram has a billion plus, right? And Instagram is a broadly appealing place for people to hang out, right? And Instagram has a very successful, you know, business powered by advertising revenue. I think almost anybody who looks at it and says, well, do I want to be more like Parler or do I want to be more like Instagram? Any business person is going to say, I want to be more like Instagram, right? So I just think it's inevitable. Now, does that mean that there aren't edge case situations that the company might decide differently under Musk than they did under Jack Dorsey? Definitely, right? And so, for example, you look at like the New York Post, Hunter Biden, you know, laptop story and how Twitter initially handled that. And I'd be willing to bet, even if Musk hadn't acquired the company, I think that they would look back on that and say, we maybe made the wrong call to block those stories. They had done it, I think, in a well-intentioned way based on what was their policy under hacked materials, which was really a reaction to the Russian attempts, disinformation attempts from 2016.
Right.
And yet, you know, when that story came up, we, you know, there was a lot that was unknown. And so I think they erred on the side of blocking it on the, you know, early sense that was based on hacked materials. And I think in hindsight, I'm not sure they would have made the same call. This is kind of, though, what I mean. Like, when you saw, I think you said, like, you know, are they going to have some sweeping philosophy about content moderation, or are they going to sort of trudge along? And I think they're going to trudge along. Why do I think that? Because every social media service has trudged along. Literally every service starts off, including Twitter, started off with, we want to allow most speech.
I think people forget that. The early days of Twitter.
People forget this. It was this. And the people forget that they still allow most speech, right?
Yeah.
And so the problem is, though, but of course, then you have all of these novel situations, right? Then you have January 6th. Never happened before. You have a sitting president stoking insurrection. Like, geez, what do we do about that? Like, we want to let elected officials say what they want, but we've never, like, this crosses some line for us, right? What do you do about vaccine information when, like, you're facing all this pressure to, like, you know, increase, improve public health? Like, that's a hard problem. So anyway, so kind of what you're seeing, I think, with these first early days of Musk owning Twitter is just that, right? You can say, like, oh, well, we're going to allow free speech, but then, you know, you see, you're immediately confronted with cases that give you cause for moderation and exceptions.
So imagine I am reaching through the screen right now. I hand you a cell phone. On the other end is a panicking Elon Musk, and he's ready to do whatever you tell him. What would you tell him?
Well, I think the thing I would say is that, like, you know, look at this path that that every social media service, including Twitter, has followed, and, you know, see if there's things to be learned from it. Be perfectly honest, which is that, you know, I mean, even, you know, last week he said they were going to form a content moderation council. That's not that different than what Facebook has tried to do with its oversight board, or what a lot of companies have tried to do, including building trust and safety teams that incorporate a lot of views. So, you know, I think that sometimes, and this is not just confined to him, I think sometimes, you know, when you look at something and you say, well, I could do that better, there's not always, you know, full appreciation of, like, what others have experienced before and, like, how they've landed at the policies they've had. And again, this is a familiar path for almost every social media service.
You mentioned it earlier from a business perspective. It seems that Twitter is, you know, well, not seems, they've stated, or Elon has stated, the desire to, you know, become less dependent on ad revenue. And I don't think that's inherently a bad thing. It's certainly more sustainable to have a subscription model. I think most news organizations can tell you that, you know, as things moved online and away from print. One of the things that they are introducing, first, they're increasing the price of a service a premium tier of account you could have called Twitter Blue. The features in the past have included being able to edit tweets that was being trialed, posting longer videos than 2 minutes and 20 seconds. The new sort of pitch, I guess I would call it, from Elon is that, you know, sure, you'll be able to do that. You'll also get less ads. And then I think the thing that a lot of people have fixated on is the ability to get verified, to get that blue tick mark next to your name, which is in theory supposed to just say this person is who they say they are. But culturally, at least on Twitter, I think that there is sort of an assumed, dignity to maybe not like there's an attribute to it, right? Because they don't hand them out to everybody. They're pretty choosy, and
there's been a scarcity of them,
right? So it creates this, you know, there's so much lamenting about, oh, the blue checks here, you know, as some sort of privileged class on Twitter. A lot of people that I've spoken to, and I've certainly read a lot of op-eds and reporting that has worried that, you know, giving out verification badges without checking people's ID or verifying that identity really is what it says it is could, you know, really dampen the website experience or enable misinformation or, you know, hate speech or whatever to essentially hijack that perceived currency that the tick mark has. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
You know, I think that the existing verification program, it's clearly like ripe for some updating and improvement, right? Because as you say, like, started off with this very definitive purpose, and I suspect that what's happening here is a little bit of a kind of conflation of a couple different goals. One is like the historic purpose of the blue check marks to essentially prevent or discourage impersonation for, you know, sort of what Twitter is considered to be kind of its like high, most visible tweeters, people involved in kind of public life or peer, you know, positions of authority, that kind of thing, who frankly face more attempts on impersonation, right? There's just like nobody's trying to impersonate, you know, average Joe on Twitter. It doesn't matter as much. So there's that challenge. There's the challenge of like, you know, the bot challenge or like the inauthentic account challenge. And, you know, if you introduce some kind of layer of authentication, does that improve the experience on Twitter? I think that's an open question too. Although I'd always want to make sure that, you know, automated accounts, which are many of which can be quite valuable, and even anonymous accounts are preserved, right? In Twitter, I think that's part of the value of Twitter. And that's valuable for speech as well, dissidents, activists, that kind of thing. But the last piece is just Twitter's like own ability, like Musk's pursuit of new revenue streams. And so, you know, in adding on this into the existing Twitter Blue. So it may be that this, you know, so like, it may be that they're, you know, smushing together a couple of things, and maybe that will last in that format. Maybe it doesn't. We'll see. And so, you know, I think like, for example, the tweets about kind of what, you know, the action they're going to take on impersonation accounts highlights the first challenge, which is like the high visible accounts are regularly impersonated. You know, it sounded to me from his tweet on that they're going to take action on that, even if the person being impersonated is not a Twitter Blue, you know, account per se, right? And so so I think that all of this, you know, frankly, is probably part of the learning curve too. And you know, and I guess in some ways we shouldn't be surprised, because if you look at like the way that Musk has run Tesla in particular, you know, he'll talk about something they're going to do, and it might not be totally ready for prime time,
right?
And you know, Tesla's unusual among vehicles in that they manufacture that they'll push out over the air updates constantly, which ordinary car manufacturers can't do. So you know, it could be that we see a lot of launch and iterate. And you know, there's two sides of that. One, some might say, well, they're not being careful enough. And other people say, well, thank goodness they're, you know, launching more, you know, more, new services and trying more things, even if some of them flop because that's good for innovation. But I just think that's who he is. That's how he's led as a product leader. You know, if you don't, one thing about that, by the way, is that like, if you don't like what they're doing, a good way to show if you don't like what they're doing is tweeting in response right. to what, you know, what Musk asks, right?
Because it, like, it does seem like he reads his replies too. Like,
totally.
And he's always, and, you know, like, and, yelling at people saying.
That's right. And so I do think like, you know, I think like they're responsive, right? He's responsive to kind of that feedback loop. So, you know, it might be, I think, frustrating for some to say, well, like, why are they doing this? So obviously it's not going to work. But, you know, like they're also, you know, this is a guy whose whole career people have told him that's not going to work. And a lot of the things he's succeeded at have been the things people said it's not going to work. So I don't think that really works with him. But I think if you can say, well, okay, you know, one thing you maybe haven't, I'm not going to say no to this, or I'm not going to be reflexively opposed to it. But here's the here's one aspect of this you maybe haven't considered. And it may be that he, you know, it's not until he sees this stuff himself that he's actually going to, you know, really focus on like the consequences of a particular policy change.
Yeah, I can definitely envision a, you know, this feature gets rolled out and then all of a sudden politicians are getting impersonated, celebrities, brands yeah. are getting impersonated. They have the yeah. blue tick. And I imagine his phone will probably catch on fire from the amount of calls that are coming in.
Well, I think you already see it. He changed his Twitter bio to, you know, chief Twitter complaint yeah. officer or something like that. And this is the thing, when I said, like, even though I think, you know, there's so many, Twitter has such a massive cultural impact that people really care about, you know, about its policies, right? It's not a public utility. It's a private company, but massive, massive sort of stakes. And of course, if they screw up, people will gravitate somewhere else. That's the ultimate thing. It's like, I know it's hard for people to kind of believe, but it's like, it really will happen if they really, you know, if they really lose users' trust.
So do you think that there are any lessons here for the broader tech industry? Like if you were, I don't know, meeting with another company and they said, wow, that Elon stuff is pretty crazy. You know, we're looking at this. We're trying to figure out, you know, is there anything we can take away from it? Do you have any thoughts on that? Anything that, you know, if, yeah, I don't think like Mark Zuckerberg listens to this podcast or anything, but you know, right. If you were talking to somebody like him and talking about the Elon situation, do you think that there's lessons for other tech companies to watch? Or, I mean, what comes to mind immediately to me is just like live vicariously and watch him learn all these things really fast and really hard.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if there's anything beyond that.
Well, I do think that probably, you know, the big companies can sort of say, look, you know, this kind of, we have been on a 10, 20 year journey on content moderation. You know, Facebook has tens of thousands of people doing content moderation because it's sort of, you know, it's clearly a big challenge. And so I think the big companies can look at that and say, you know, yeah, like they're on the journey that we were on a long time ago. My guess is the flip side of that is that probably in their heart of hearts, people in some of the big companies may look at the speed of rollout of some of these new features under Musk and be a little envious at how fast Twitter is able to move. It's harder to get, you know, things executed and done quickly when a company's bigger. And so my guess is there's kind of trade-offs in both ways.
So one of the things, you know, as we're wrapping up here that has concerned me about Twitter, and I'd be curious your take on it, is what I mentioned earlier, sort of who he's surrounding himself with. And, you know, the fact that he's interacting with accounts like Cat Turd 2, which is just like conspiracy, clickbait, nonsense, pro-Trump stuff. When we're talking about weighing the business decisions versus weighing maybe the ideological ones, I guess one of my concerns is that some of the folks he's surrounding himself with, you know, do have very hard ideological lines. And those ideological lines don't necessarily, you know, on their face, they may say, oh, this is about free speech, this is about free expression. But then, you know, you read the blogs of what these people would actually want to do. And it's, right. you know, at least to me, I read that and I go, well, that's not really pursuing that goal at all. That would make it like imagine if these guys were like, Black Lives Matter is a terrorist movement, actually. And then all of that gets banned on Twitter. That is not promoting free speech, right?
Yeah.
So as far as, you know, striking that balance, I guess, Do you have any concerns? You know, I know a lot of how you look at this is like, you know, there are business decisions to be made and that's going to pull him a certain direction. But I'm curious what you think, like how concerned should someone like me or someone like my listeners be about the influences of those, you know, folks around him that do have these very hard ideologies that could, you know, I'm sure they're going to try their damnedest to work against those business incentives that would otherwise guide him to more reasonable spaces.
Right. Well, look, I mean, I would be concerned if that happened too. I think, but let's play this out. Like, I do think that, like, if Elon Musk, you know, at the urging of some MAGA commenter type, you know, said Black Lives Matter posts are now banned on Twitter, I think there would be a massive outcry from civil rights organizations. And I think, frankly, you'd probably see most of their advertisers, you know, dry up almost immediately, right? Because that's just not, you know, that's just not where most of the public is. And that's where I just, you know, I think it's one thing to be, you know, replying to cat turd.
Yeah.
And then it's a different thing to see, like, you know, how are you running the business, right? And so it's possible that that extends over to how they run the business. But it's also possible that it sort of stays in the realm of, like, you know, just like the occasional reply or like tweet. So I don't want to dismiss that too, because the fact is, like, we know that that kind of content can lead to radicalization, can lead to, you know, and so we definitely need to be aware of that. And also, I think, you know, I hope that he is aware of that. And you know, we're kind of past the point at which, you know, people saying, well, we're just asking questions. You know, look at the New York Times did a really interesting piece on the reaction and kind of the right wing conspiracy ecosystem around the attack on Paul Pelosi and how that was, you know, spread not just on tweets, must tweet on it, but also, you know, on Fox News and Tucker Carlson's posts and things like that. And, you know, I think that was, you know, that was pretty irresponsible of all the people who spread that. So, you know, I hope that people have, you know, take a greater degree of responsibility about kind of not spreading that. And of course, platforms hopefully, you know, play a role in stopping the spread of that kind of thing.
I've been talking with Adam Kovacevic about Elon's takeover of Twitter. Adam, I've really appreciated this conversation, and having that kind of perspective, I think, is really useful, because there's a lot of doom saying right now. And, you know, we can't predict the future. Maybe it will be doom and gloom, but I definitely think there are reasons to look at this and, you know, maybe be a little bit more hopeful, or at the very least be more cautious with our doom saying. So, Adam, every guest on this podcast gets the same last question. So here it is for you. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Well, last couple of months, I have become strangely transfixed by this YouTube channel operated by a McDonald's manager. And I don't know where he's located, but he puts a head cam on and films his shifts as a McDonald's manager. And he'll like have 5 minutes on like the breakfast rush and 5 minutes on like fries. And it is fascinating. First of all, no wasted motion whatsoever, right? And just, he's just so incredibly efficient. But you just also have to admire, and I'm an efficiency nut, admire the design of McDonald's restaurant kitchen, right? To encourage that kind of speed and efficiency. It's really, really impressive. So I'm not too embarrassed to say that I've gotten into this, because they are weirdly compelling, but really cool to see.
Cool. Shoot me a link and I'll put that in the description. Also in the description, listeners, you can find a link to Adam's Twitter profile, so long as it still exists, I guess. And I'll also include a link to the Chamber of Progress website if you want to learn more about what Adam and his team are doing. So, Adam, thanks so much for coming on the show this week. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.